This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. There are not many scientists who are celebrities these days. Stephen Hawking might qualify, but it's a pretty short list. And there certainly are not many scientists today who would command a two-day run at Milwaukee's Riverside Theater.
Well, our first guest this morning is that guy. Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson is an astrophysicist and the hugely popular host of the relaunched classic TV series Cosmos, which got an endorsement from an influential television critic, President Obama.
America has always been a nation of fearless explorers who dream bigger and reach farther than others imagine. That's the spirit of discovery that Carl Sagan captured in the original Cosmos. Today, we're doing everything we can to bring that same sense of possibility to a new generation, because there are new frontiers to explore, and we need Americans eager to explore them. There are no limits, so open your eyes and open your imagination. The next great discovery could be yours.
President Obama introducing the first episode of the relaunched TV show Cosmos, which was originally hosted by the iconic cosmologist Carl Sagan.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is the current host of Cosmos, will be at the Riverside Wednesday and Thursday to talk about, well, everything. But he joins us first from his office at the Hayden Planetarium in New York. Dr. Tyson, welcome to Lake Effect. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, and that's a great title for the show, Lake Effect.
Thank you. I cannot take credit for it. My boss, Mitch Teich, came up with that when he took over as executive producer, and he said, you know, we're right by a great lake. That's what we should be.
I like a geographically literate referencing like that.
Exactly. Well, we are very excited to have you come to Milwaukee here by Lake Michigan. And you're going to be here two nights talking about a couple of different topics both nights, and it's the second night's topic that I want to start with, which is science as a way of knowing. And I want to start with why that is so important for non-scientists.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I'm less evangelical about this than people sometimes make me out to be, because I didn't knock on your door to say, let me in so I can tell you this. I'm a scientist, and I, at any occasion that I have, I will share my love of the universe and of science in general with people. But what you need to know is that if you foster science literacy in yourself, in your family, in your school, you empower yourself to be a participant in the economic growth of the future of your country. We've known since the Industrial Revolution and before that innovations in science and technology are the engines of the growth economies of the future. So even if you were not a curious person, even if you don't like science, here in America, we live we're a capitalist democracy. People care about money, and in a way that we're not even ashamed of. We all just care about money. I don't have an issue with that. And if you continue to do so, you need to know what role and value science, technology, engineering, and math plays in this enterprise. So I think I'm just helping people gain wealth in the future. Other than that, I just stay home.
Well, what about science just as wanting to know, like the curiosity part of it?
I'll take that too. That's why I do it. I don't do it to gain national wealth. I do it because I think the universe is fascinating. I think all frontiers, all boundaries between what is known and unknown are fascinating. I'm drawn to them. But even if you're not drawn to them, don't you want to live in a world where the people who are can produce product and tools that improve your way of life or make life more interesting to live? Or at the other extreme, can make fundamental contributions to major problems that face society today. In the production of food, access to clean water, transportation, energy, housing. These are major challenges that our growing population has not fully resolved. And you're not going to find a solution to that in any other place but in the traditional STEM fields. Not that I know of, or not that history has demonstrated that you will. So I want to make science something that people can celebrate, where they no longer think of it as, well, that was a class that I took, and now I'm going to step around it or over it or dig under it. You need to recognize that science is everywhere, not the least of which in decisions you will have to make when you vote for candidates on political issues that affect your future.
Well, how do you combat the fact that a healthy minority of Americans say they don't, quote unquote, believe in science and choose to, as you say, ignore it?
It's one thing to ignore it, then at least you're self-aware that you're ignoring science. What's a little more insidious, if that's the right word, are people who cherry-pick science in ways that serve their own philosophies, be it cultural philosophy, religious philosophy. It could be some other way of thinking that you've adopted for yourself where some aspects of science serve that philosophy and others don't. So you cherry-pick it, and then you deny the science that doesn't agree with what you want to be true. That's a little more insidious. That's a little more dangerous, actually, especially if you have the power to affect legislation. What I mean by dangerous is you think you are understanding truth, the emergent truths brought to you by the investments of science and technology, but you do not. And now you want to create laws based on this that affect other people who do understand it or other people who don't share your philosophy. That's what makes it's a destabilizing force on a democracy. And I don't think that's the country I grew up in. The United States, when I grew up in the 20th century, second half, I think people understood the value of science, even if they didn't understand science itself.
So how did we lose that? What happened?
I have no idea. What, do you think I have answers to everything? I don't know. I mean, I have a guess. And I'm not going to fight anyone over whether this is true, but it's a plausibility case that back in the second half, we won the war, and we won it on science and technology with the invention of the bomb. And we won it on our production lines, where the technology of to mass produce weaponry, all right? So the awareness of science and technology was real and ever present. Now we come out of the 1950s, new inventions are making the homes. I remember seeing ads. Now the housewife will have more free time because of this new dishwasher. And you look at the attempt of people to introduce technology into our lives to lessen the burdens that existed previously. So there's an awareness factor that existed then. We come into the 1960s. We're going to the moon. This was an impossible dream for so many millennia, and now we're actually going to the moon. How do you get things to the moon? You need science and technology to do this. And people went a little bat crazy after Sputnik, where the Russians, our enemy, a country where we want the rest of the world to think is inferior to us in every way that matters, and they're putting technology over our head without our permission. Because there's no treaty that says, there are treaties that said you can't fly over a country's airspace without permission. But the space part, there's your airspace and there's the space. There was no rules about that. And so here we had our arch enemy flying hardware over our head, and we just freaked. And again, it's all science and technology. And what happens? We go to the moon, and then we stop going to the moon. And then all of a sudden, newspaper headlines no longer contain the celebration of technological feats. And I think ever since we stopped going to the moon, we've become complacent about what role technology has played because we don't have the big headlines telling us about it anymore. And when you become complacent, you get these cases. This is probably apocryphal, but it captures the point. Get people saying, why do I need a space program? I've got my GPS and I have the Weather Channel. I don't need anything else. Well, where did you get that photo of the hurricane that's ready to level your city? Where do you think the programming that went into predicting the path of that storm? All of this is the science and technology brought to you from space. So I think we've grown accustomed to it. And maybe we just need a really big project again that daily puts forward what the value is of space in the role of exploration and in bettering life on Earth.
It's so ironic because we live in such a technological world. You mentioned GPS. I mean, most of us are tethered to our smartphones. We are connected in ways that we could only dream of in the 1960s and 70s. And somehow as you say, we don't equate that with scientific discovery and achievement.
Right. And in fact, there are other elements of this. There's a growing faction of people in the country that are fundamentally anti-government, on the premise that the government is inefficient, and what do we need them for other than for the common defense? And I see and understand where they're coming from, some of the frustrations. But on balance, I will rather have government than no government. A government, for example, that funds basic research that cannot be picked up by private enterprise, because basic research does not serve a quarterly report or an annual report. It serves a much longer term horizon. And there's a great discussion, I forgot the way to find it on the web, but it's there, where you look at the anatomy of your smartphone. Well, where did the touchscreen come from? Well, that came from a government grant to someone who wanted to set up info kiosks in the Library of Congress, right? So that's where touchscreens came from. That is the first touchscreen. And there it is, fully taken for granted as a blended part of our modern daily life. And that was a government grant that enabled that. And you go on down the line, the discoveries that have been made. And we can go back in time, for example. In the 1920s was the discovery of quantum physics. In the day, what might you have told those physicists? Why are you looking at the atom? You can't even see the atom. And who cares that the atom exists? I know I have iron here, and I've got a gas, and I've got... Why study the atom? It was a frontier curiosity, entertaining physicists. No one had any clue how it would ever be manifest. Einstein wrote a paper called On the Stimulated Emission of Radiation. Do you know something? That became the foundation for the laser 40 years later, 50 years later. But Einstein wasn't thinking, gee, barcodes, that's why I'm going to write this paper. He's not thinking that. No. LASIK surgery. So it's government, institutional investments that have very long sight lines that enable major advances to take place in your culture because of the impact that science and technology has on it, and the fact that it's being conducted by a community of people that are drawn to that frontier. So if we don't have big projects in front of us, I worry that the influence, the free influence you get when the media talks about the great discoveries, is not there, and we all just become complacent.
What kind of big projects would you like to see? If you were a ruler of the universe...
No, I would only have to be ruler of Earth for this. You don't have to bring the whole universe into that in that example. I would say I'm biased, of course, but I'm not secret about my bias. I would love to explore space as though it were our backyard. What that would require, for example, is a suite of launch vehicles for all different needs and purposes. So some scientists walk up and say, we want to look for life on Mars. Well, that would be this vehicle, this spacecraft, with this combination of rockets that you strap on in this way. Oh, we want to mine an asteroid. Well, that would be this set of rockets. And you're going to start a business there. That's great. There we have entrepreneurs. We want to send tourists to a moon base. That's a different set of rockets. And then all of a sudden, we have these links to the rest of the universe made possible by an intelligently conceived suite of launch vehicles. To accomplish this will require innovations, will require patents being awarded, will require business models to be created. And all of a sudden, space goes from being a space program to becoming a space industry. That's the kind of future I want. And then every week we'll say, oh, they just found a deposit of gold or platinum on an asteroid. Oh, there's a cool thing that happened up on the moon. There's a new athletic activity that involves weightless, airless baseball, okay? Well, you can't throw a curveball. Show me that. That's a new TV show, the reality show from the moon. I mean, you can go on and on and on about how you would bring in space and fold it into our daily lives. If we did that, that would completely transform what life on Earth would be all about.
You're talking about a really amazing and somewhat utopian view, I think, of both private industry and government industry working very, very well together, which they have in the past.
Yeah. For example, this is not widely retold, not that it's a secret, but for example, NASA didn't build the lunar module, the thing that landed on the moon. That was built and designed by Grumman Aerospace. they're still on Long Island, but at the time that was built on Long Island, New York. So the way NASA works is they build some things within their own labs and other things are contracted out. So we have had a long relationship, NASA have had a long relationship with private enterprise, but when it was finally delivered, it had NASA logo on the side. The difference now is NASA might say, we want to bring cargo to the space station. Who's going to be the one? And then aerospace companies compete, and now NASA rents space in the payload bay of SpaceX or of Orbital or Orbital Sciences or of some company that competes for that role. That's great. That should have been happening 30 years ago. It's a slightly different business model from NASA contracting to have parts made and elements made for their craft. This is an outright who's going to do the science and technology, and since it's private enterprise, they'll do it more efficiently than the government ever will. And we all know this, and that's why it should have been happening 30 years ago.
And yet you need that government oversight, as you say, to have that long view.
Yes, you need the long view. And same with the post office. You know, the post office today, they don't have their own airplanes. They rent space in the belly of Delta Airlines or wherever. And they're relying on the efficiencies of the business model of a commercial air carrier to carry mail from one point to another. We have good examples of that being a successful way to do things in the relationship between private enterprise and business. And I don't see why space couldn't fully exploit that fact as well. But it means private enterprise will not lead the frontier. They can't because there's no business model on the frontier. You know, is it expensive? Yes. Is it dangerous? Yes. People will probably die. What's my return on investment? I don't know. Probably nothing. Well, how am I going to get backers for that if I'm trying to explore the universe privately? It's you could do it as a one-off, but not as a business model. So the government does that. And then when they figure out where the trade winds are, where the hostiles and the friendlies are, and what are the efficiencies that need to be explored, then they can say, now we have the maps. Now we know what the dangers are. Private enterprise, now see if you can make a buck doing it. And that's really how it needs to be, if it's going to happen at all.
Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson will have more of our interview with him after a short break. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Let's get back to our interview with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. He'll be at the Riverside Theater later this week. Well, I want to ask a little bit about some science stuff in general. And specifically, one of my friends and I were talking about the fact that I was going to be having this conversation with you. And he said, would you please ask him about dark matter? And are we any closer to proving that it exists?
No. Okay, next question.
Okay.
We are no closer. We don't know what it is. We are clueless. Not completely clueless. We have very few clues. And we have what we think are clues, but I don't know how good they are. Particle physicists feel pretty confident that it's another kind of particle that doesn't interact with our kinds of particles. And there's precedent for that, so they're not pulling this out of space, out of the ether. But sometimes I worry that if you're a hammer, then all your problems look like nails. If you're a particle physicist, then all the unsolved problems are solved by thinking you have particles that are responsible for it. So it remains a mystery, and we're not really any closer to finding the answer to dark matter.
Okay. What about more than four dimensions in space-time?
Oh, sure. I don't know how we can test for it, but there's strong reason to suggest that the actual reality in which we live has more dimensions than just the three spatial dimensions and one time dimension. In fact, if there is a multiverse, where at the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang, we would have had many universes coming and going, being birthed and dying and expanding and contracting or not contracting, and as because we will never contract, you can imagine an ensemble of universes, which we will call the multiverse. In that scenario, that has to be embedded in a higher dimension because there's no other way to do that. Otherwise, we'd be bumping elbows in the space that we occupy. So, yeah, we're good with the higher dimensional space in which we live.
I kind of like that idea of bumping elbows. That's the science fiction nerd in me.
Yeah, well, let me follow through on that. There are some models that suggest that the dark matter that we experience, it's really dark gravity, because it's gravity and we don't know what its origin is. Dark matter implies you already know that it's matter. So it's a slightly misleading term. What it really is dark gravity. It may be ordinary gravity in a parallel universe, one of these that came off the multiverse, whose influence we feel across the membranes of our two universes. Now that's an interesting thought. And that's a way to detect something that doesn't even exist in your own space-time. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, oh yeah. And then you don't need the extra particles, but you do need to invoke a parallel universe.
Right, right. So the particle physicists won't be happy.
Well, yeah, I'm sure they'd rather it be a particle, but we'd all be happy if anyone knew what it is at all.
Exactly. And so that leads me to a question about how we think about the universe. Obviously, these sorts of things, if proven true, however we prove them to be true, are going to fundamentally change how we perceive where we are and what we're doing and how it all fits together. Do you see this happening in our lifetimes or fractions of that happening in our lifetime?
Well, sure. So there's the search for life in the universe, intelligent or otherwise. There's the profound state of ignorance that we live with, not knowing what dark matter is or dark energy. If you combine dark matter and dark energy together, they account for 95% or so of what is driving this universe. And we are completely ignorant about what they are, although we can measure their existence. And so it's an interesting state of ignorance to be in. In my field, you have to, at some point, learn to love the questions. Because not all answers are there for you, or not immediately, or maybe we're awaiting the birth of a new Einstein to rise up and free us from this, the weight of the dark side, the dark matter, dark energy. So, but if we have solutions to any one of those questions, they would be scientifically profound. But one can also ask, will they be profound culturally or intellectually? Or will you lose your religion? Or, you know, it's hard to predict on that scale how people would react to profound adjustments to our understanding of our place in the universe.
Yeah, I can't imagine that it wouldn't be anything but profound, that you'd have to react to it in some way, but what that way is, of course, we won't know until it happens.
Yeah, well, we have some evidence. For example, if you go back to Darwin's day when he published The Origin of Species, that was a profound shift in our understanding of our origins. When Isaac Newton wrote down his equations for gravity and motion, he empowered us all to understand and predict the planetary paths in the night sky, the paths of the planets in orbit around the sun and what they look like from Earth. And if you thought that the heavens were unknowable because that's where God resides and God is unknowable because God is divine and we're mere mortals, and you were content in your answer, we don't understand these planet orbits because it is the handiwork of a divine being whose brain we will never know. And then Isaac Newton comes around and writes down an equation. Now you understand it and can predict for it. That could be highly unsettling for you. So I think it matters, what is your investment going in to cosmic discovery? And if it's modest or none at all, then everything is just a joyous surprise. If your investment is heavy in your belief system of what is true or not true, and some profound discovery gets made, then you're, you know, SOL, as they say. Yes, you're going to have to rethink your place in this world. And it meant you came in, perhaps, with an ego slightly larger than deserved.
I hope I'm on the former, where it's just kind of like everything's open and it's just like, yeah, whatever.
Well, when you're a scientist on the frontier, you have to be open to whatever. You can actually bias yourself by asserting in advance that something needs to be of one kind of truth versus another.
And yet, as humans, we all come in with biases, even if we think we're not.
Yeah, in fact, scientists have biases. So that's why we developed the scientific method. If I were to paraphrase the scientific method, it's to reduce as much as is possible the bias you bring to an experiment that would have you think something is true that is not, or have something you think is not true that is. That's the scientific method. Do whatever it takes to avoid that bias. And if it means writing something down or getting video recordings or getting chart readings, obtaining an artifact of an idea, this is how you'd have to roll.
Well, and you know, I think that is a great way to live life.
Yeah, I agree, actually. I agree, and you become open to people who are different from you, and it's a live and let live philosophy, actually.
Absolutely.
At its core.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully you'll leave yourself open enough to see what's actually there.
Yeah, and a good scientist will. The scientist goes in with no irreversible bias. If you have biases, you're not in the game. And if your biases get revealed in your next research paper, you've just dropped a few notches on the likelihood that someone will pay attention to your next research paper. The penalties are severe.
Is there anything that you miss doing with all of the stuff you are, you know, you're sort of the face of cosmology right now, and you are directing the planetarium, you're doing a lot of outreach work in that way. Is there any kind of research that you wish you had time to do?
Oh, yeah, I try not to wish for things because that implies you're not in control.
Sorry.
Not that I don't mind being in control, I just won't wish for it to change. If I want it to change, I'll go try to change it. So that's why I try not to be wishful or hopeful. I try to be a man of action when the time comes. But I would say there's tons of frontiers in the research astrophysics community that I would jump right into if I had more time. And I'm in the process of cleaving more time in my calendar just so that what I'm telling you now becomes a reality rather than just sort of vaporware. And I'm still intrigued from the days of my PhD thesis regarding the structure of galaxies, the birth, life, and death of stars, the large-scale structure of the universe and of galaxies. I'm pretty broad in that regard, and I have colleagues who are still active in all those fields, and I'll be knocking on their door very shortly as I clear more time out in my calendar.
Terrific. I can't wait to see what you come up with.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Well, Dr. Tyson, we are so looking forward to having you here in Milwaukee for the two evenings at the Riverside Theater. And thank you so much for taking time out of what I know is an incredibly busy schedule.
Yeah. Thank you for thinking that. It's a little overwhelming at times, but I have the universe as my engine with limitless fuel to keep going. So that's why I'm still there.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. He's also host of the relaunched television series Cosmos on the Fox and National Geographic networks. Tyson will be at the Riverside Theater in Milwaukee Wednesday and Thursday nights.
A shift to science fiction after a break and a conversation with our film contributor about the new film Interstellar when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Science is real. From Astrophysics.